Okay. Let me kind of tell you what's happening. Matthew, we remember, if we go back to chapter 12, we find that the Jewish leadership rejects Jesus. When we move into chapter 13, Jesus changes his methodology of teaching. Now it's parables. He does so because those who have rejected him won't understand, and those who are still seeking after him will understand. And when we got to chapter 14, we had Jesus revealing himself even more with him when he was walking on the water. If you remember, and from Job chapter 9, it is God who walks on the waves of the sea. That's why the disciples responded the way they did, and they saw it was really Jesus and not a ghost that was walking on the water. So things have shifted. He's been rejected primarily by the Jewish leadership. He's also now revealed himself more clearly to the disciples. They don't have it fully figured out yet, but they understand that he's more than a carpenter from Nazareth. He's more than a miracle worker. He's more than a traveling rabbi. They know that now. They haven't got it all quite worked out, but they know that now he's the Son of God. When we get to chapter 15, where we are tonight, we're going to find that Jesus confronts his critics once again, but he shifts. This is important. This is Matthew's gospel. He shifts to focus more on the Gentiles. And that's surprising. That's surprising. We're going to see that in two different accounts of what takes place in Jesus' ministry here. There's going to be the feeding of the 4,000. Yes, we talked about the 5,000, but now the 4,000. In addition to that, there's going to be the Syrophoenician woman, who is a Gentile, by the way, that comes to Jesus pleading with him. And her response to Jesus astounds Jesus. He's surprised by it. He's delighted by it. And we'll see that. Okay, so first, the confrontation. Then the scribes and the Pharisees, who were from Jerusalem, came to Jesus saying, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread." We're introduced to something now called the tradition of the elders. The tradition of the elders was oral, it was memorized, and it was handed down for several centuries by this time. And it finally was codified in writing in the Mishnah about 200 AD, AD 200. And basically what it was a series of traditions that had developed through the rabbis, the rabbinical schools, as well as other religious leaders. And most people just adopted them without question. They during that intertestamental period of time, that 400 years between the close of Malachi and the beginning of Matthew, a lot happened during that period of time. That's where the Pharisees actually came out of that period of history. And the scribes, of course, are the teachers among the Pharisees, as well as we call them more like professors, experts. And during that period of time, there was a movement and a desire for people to obey God in ways that historically the Jews had not. And what they wanted, it kind of good intentioned, but it works out in a very unintentional way, in the sense that it puts a burden on people, and it's really not obeying God's law. We've talked about the hedge about the law, the 613 laws that surround the Ten Commandments, how you would make sure that you did not break one of those. Primarily, the one that's most contentious is the keeping the Sabbath. That's the one that Jesus and the Pharisees kind of clash over more than any other. And here they approach Jesus, and they're making an accusation against Jesus by focusing on something his disciples did not do. They ate without ceremony. Now, it's not hygiene. This is not your mom calling out, "Now, before you eat supper, wash your hands." No, it's not that at all. It's a ceremonial kind of thing. where they washed their hands. And Jesus' disciples didn't do that. So the Pharisees are wondering, oh, why is it that you allow this? So really, even though the disciples are the focus, Jesus is the intended target. Why haven't you taught them? Why haven't you taught them to obey and observe the traditions of the elders? Jesus' response to that is quite, I would say, surprising to them. Because they're talking about traditions of the elders. You got that, right? Listen to what Jesus says. And he answered and said to them, why do you transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? Jesus is not going to talk about tradition. He's going to talk about God's commandment. So they're talking about, you know, different. Now, the Pharisees probably assumed that these traditions were enabling people to keep the commandments. And Jesus, he doesn't buy that. He just goes, well, listen, you have traditions. God has given us commandments. Why do you use your traditions to violate, break God's commandments? And then he goes to a particular one. For God commanded, saying in verse 4, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses his father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever says to his father and mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is a gift to God, then he need not to honor his father or his mother. Thus, you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition. And he's going to get very, very stern with them in verse 7. So what they had done is called Corban. And what it is, Corban, is that you could, according to the tradition of the elders, you could say that my property, my money, I dedicate to God in the temple. Once you did that, you were free from any responsibility of caring for anyone. I don't know where it was. I got a funny story just a minute about that. Not you, but about what happened. Anyway, so what it was doing, now, how do you honor your father and your mother? Remember, those commandments were given to adults, not children. Because a lot of times we immediately think of, well, you obey your parents, that kind of stuff. No, that's not who they were given to. They're given first to adults. So how do you honor your father and your mother?
Take care of them.
You take care of them. When they get to the place they can no longer care for themselves, you see to it they're cared for. So that's the commandment. And that's how Jesus is interpreting it. And he's telling them that, listen, you've taken the traditions of the elders, and what you have done is you have nullified a commandment of God. You don't have to take care of your parents because you've dedicated your property to God. There's your loophole. So now you don't have to. And Jesus is, he's going to get really harsh with them. And the harsh tone of Jesus with the Pharisees and their scribes is going to come to a crescendo a little bit later in Matthew. Matthew 23, to be precise. And he is not pulling any punches. And he's going to go after them right here now. If you have bought into the misrepresentation of Jesus, that, you know, sweet little Jesus, meek and mild, he did not hurt anyone's feelings, he was always concerned about how people felt, you need to get that notion out of your head. And that's the real Jesus, not the caricature of the made-up one. Verse 7 tells us why. He begins with a single word, hypocrites. That's a strong word. Now, we all know what that is. It's somebody who pretends to be something they're not. That's a hypocrite. And there's probably a little bit of hypocrisy in a lot of people. Maybe all of us have from one time or another. But he's talking specifically about these religious leaders. They pretended to be something that they were not. They outwardly looked like they were a certain thing, but in reality, in their heart, they were anything but. And the word hypocrite, you probably are aware that the word hypocrite, the ones translated to us as a hypocrite, means actually actor. And a hypocrite was a person in the Greco-Roman world that would act on a stage, you know, in a probably more like an amphitheater kind of thing. And one actor would play several different parts. And what separated the actors is he would have a mask. And once he was giving the lines for one character, he would hold a mask up. And he would, and when he was talking and giving the lines for another character in the play, he would hold a different mask up, indicating to the people who is speaking. And, you know, if you got just a one-man show, it's a pretty good way of doing it. All right? So that was working. But you understood that the picture was vivid. The person was pretending to be somebody that they were not. So he talks to about the Pharisees and their scribes, hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, "These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." So what does Jesus do? Well, he just brings scripture to bear on their situation. You pretending that you're righteous by observing all of these minute details, but you're not. You're not. He will also compare them to being a whitewashed tomb. Really looks good on the outside. Well manicured, you know, nice and painted, but inside you're full of filthiness and dead men's bones. We'll get to that. That's an indictment. To try to put it in a way that should be rememberable, but it's very poor English. If you ain't who you is who you ain't. And you can let that kind of soak in for a little bit, because that can happen a lot with people pretending to be one way when really, in reality, they're a different way. And it's easy to fall into that category. But Jesus is not going to tolerate it. As a matter of fact, he blasts them. How could you do this? And then he quotes from Isaiah, someone they would revere, and points out that you honor me with your lips, but your heart's not there. You say the words, but you don't mean them. You say it, but it's not real. It's not true. When he called the multitude to himself, he said to them, "Hear and understand." So there are people that are around him, and they're listening to this encounter with the Pharisees. They've heard Jesus' response, and they probably really like it. Somebody finally is dressing them down like they need to be. Finally, someone who's not being just bowled over by their arrogance. Probably they were liking it a bit. And so after that, he calls people to himself. He says, "Now, I want you to think about this. I want you to consider this." When he called the multitude to himself, he said to them, "Hear and understand. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a man, but what comes out of the mouth, this defiles the man." He's waking them up with just some common sense. And remember, we talked about the ceremonial washing. One of the methods of ceremonial washing was to get the demons off of your fingers. You don't want to eat one. You don't want to consume one when you eat. So they would take their fingers, they would dip them in the water, just the fingers, hold them up like this, and it would, you know, run down and drip off your elbow. And that ceremonial washing was an indication that you were cleansing yourself of any kind of demonic influence. Now, the Sadducees probably didn't care anything about that because they didn't believe in demons anyway. But the Pharisees did. So he tells them, it's not what goes in, it's what comes out. That's the problem. It's the problem. Then his disciples came to him. Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying? Jesus, did you not catch that? You hurt their feelings. You offended them. Can I just insert something here? If Jesus does not offend you from time to time, you're not paying close enough attention. Just read through the Sermon on the Mount and really take it into heart. If that doesn't get you, nothing will. Did you not notice it offended them? Probably the way they stomped off. Probably a good indication. But he answered and said, verse 13, every plant which my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind leads the blind, both will fall into a ditch. Don't go after them. Don't go after them. Leave them alone. They're blind. And they are. Or were. And you'll meet people who are spiritually blind. If you meet people at all, eventually you're going to come across those because they're everywhere. They don't get it. They don't understand it. And even your explanation, as best intended, is if you try your very best, they still look at you like, I don't get it. And don't be surprised by that. And one thing else, too, don't be offended by it. You're not going to make the light come on. You can't do that. I can't do that. So let that monkey crawl off your back. You are not the one that will enable the light come on. That's the Spirit's job. He can do that. We can't. And don't be offended when someone just says they just don't get it or they don't seem to care because they just don't get it. Can you imagine this scenario? You're walking out on a nice warm evening. You're looking at one of the most beautiful sunsets you've seen in maybe years. The colors are brilliant. As the sun going down, you have beside you a person who can't see. They're blind. And you begin trying to describe what you're seeing to them. And they say, I just don't understand it. Would you get really mad at them and call them? What's wrong with you? Can't you see it? No, you can't see. But for these people, remember what's going on. Not every Pharisee became so hard-hearted that they rejected Jesus. But the majority of them did. And they did it on the basis of, he does not line up with us. And we know we're right. And since he does not line up with us, then he must be of, like we've already talked about, Beelzebub, the prince of demons. Okay. We'll go a little bit further. Then Peter answered and said to him, explain this parable to us. So Jesus said, are you still without understanding? Do you not yet understand that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then is eliminated? But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. It's what comes out from the heart. For what's in the heart? Well, in verse 19, evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. Kind of a unpleasant list when you look at it. That's what comes out of the heart. So you probably are beginning to understand now that where's the problem? It's the heart. Your seat of being. It's fallen. And because of that, that's what will come proceeding out of that. You can do all kinds of things to try to make people be better. If you have the power, you can force them. And they may toe the line. But you're not fixing the problem. A little professor years ago told the story of, I guess it was his child, because this goes all the way back to college days. And he was talking about, it was a supper table, and his 4-year-old son was standing up in the chair. He said, "Son, sit down." He wouldn't do it. "Sit down." Finally, he kind of shifted his chair like he was going to get up, and the boy sat down, folded his arms, tilted his head down, and he spoke to him again. What are you doing? He said, "I'm still standing up on the inside." That's how we are. That's the problem. And that's what Jesus points out here. He says, but these things, well, we've already looked at that. In verse 20, these are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands, it does not defile a man. You're not defiled by not keeping that tradition. You're defiled by what comes out of your mouth, because that is because it's connected to your heart. It's showing what's there. What's there? Comments or questions? All righty.
Is this ceremonial hand washing, is that the same as what the men do when they go to the wall or before the Sabbath?
There probably are some ceremonial washing going on there. Remember, it's not just unique to Jews. Muslims do that. They have a ceremonial washing that they do too. At least some of them do.
Don't you think it's hard as believers when we share what we have to keep in mind what you've talked about, the blindness of the person? The God of this world has blinded the minds of those so that they won't see the light of what we're trying to share. And that makes it so hard for us to remember that, because we get discouraged and we want to quit. And just an observation.
It is. You know, we would like to think that maybe our powers of persuasion are strong enough that we can persuade people to be Christians. Now, there are those that are very gifted at being able to talk to people, and seemingly they can get them to the foot of the cross pretty quickly. But not everybody can do that. Not everybody's given that gift or that kind of winsomeness to be able to do that. But even those people, they're not taught. If you talk somebody into the kingdom, you've done both them and yourself a disservice. Because you really haven't talked them into it. You've just convinced them to buy what you're selling, but they really they're probably, there's no conversion going on there. I don't know. Have you ever, I don't know, Bob or Dallas, have you ever converted somebody to yourself? I did that once, and it's probably one of the most painful experiences in my life, because he turned on me like a rabid dog, and that metaphor is not an overstatement, okay? You got to be careful. Let God do the convicting. Let God do the converting. We're not adequate for that, and we're not told to do that either. We're to be my witnesses, Jesus says. Anyway, let's go. Now we're going to get to that. This conflict is over. Now he's moving. He's much further north. Then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. That's old Phoenician territory. There's a very famous person in the Old Testament that came from that area. There'll be a Bible trivia for you there. Anybody know who she was? Last name, half of her name, the last part is Bell.
Yes.
Jezebel. That's where she came from. And she brought the worst form of paganism into Israel. Anyway. And he went to the Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." But he answered her not a word. not a word. And you kind of picture this. She comes and she's pleading with Jesus. Perhaps he can keeps on walking, as if he's not really paying attention to her request. And the disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us." But he answered and he said, now he's speaking in her direction, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And she came and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, help me." Now, if you back up a little bit, what does she call him? Lord, but something else.
Son of David.
So she is addressing him as Messiah. But then Jesus' response, it sounds to us harsh. Especially when we get to the dog passage here in just a minute. It sounds like he's getting really harsh with her. I'm not going to be able to... I'm just going to give you an alternate way of perhaps thinking about this encounter. The one thing that we are not seeing... And remember, communication... There is a lot of communication that's connected to perceiving, seeing. We are not seeing this encounter. We're not hearing the encounter. We are just reading the words that were said. You follow what I'm saying? So we don't know. There are ways to say something quite harsh, and by body language you indicate you're not being harsh at all. You know what I mean? You can say something that sounds harsh but be smiling and going, you know, something like that. And the person that you're speaking to will pick up on that. We don't know. There is a project that was done a number of years ago called the Visual Bible, as Matthew. And what it is, it's a representation of the Gospel of Matthew and all the red letters that you find in a red letter Bible, the Gospel of Matthew. That's what the actor playing the part of Jesus said. He memorized all of the red letters. And but the thing about him, he's an actor, his name is Bruce Marciano. And the one thing that he did, though, is his portrayal of Jesus is different than any of the others that I've seen. Because he takes his concept of Jesus from Hebrews. "For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of God." So he understood, and his perception that Jesus was far more joyous than some of the different representations of the past. I know some of those, it looks like, you know, so solemn, you know, that the actor must be a Baptist. Because he is just so solemn, he doesn't smile, just so serious. And I've told you before, Jesus told jokes. We just don't recognize them because we don't understand Hebrew humor. But he told jokes. And one of the clearest ways that jokes were told by Hebrews of that day was exaggeration. You exaggerate. For us, jokes become funny with a punchline. But to that day, according to those who study these kind of things, it is actually the overstatement that's funny. So think about it. The Pharisees, they strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. We're all serious. That's a joke. That's funny. Because Hebrews, for the most part, because of their worldview, they were very literal thinkers. That's why the Old Testament has all of these metaphors. God is my rock. God is this. God is that. He's my shepherd. He's the God who sees me, all that kind of stuff. That's how they would think. So when they would hear something like that, they would see it in their heads. You know, can you imagine? You know, have you ever sucked in a gnat or a bug? You know that, you know, I say this kiddingly, but you might as well just swallow and get over with. Because it's there. And you're going to hack and spit and carry on, and when you get it out, you still think you haven't got it out. I don't know how I got up on that, but back in Bruce Marciano, he plays a Jesus that smiles and laughs and that kind of thing. And this encounter, Marciano does such a good job, I think. Because he says these words, but you can tell by his body language what he means. You know, in one, the disciples come, send her away, and he's going, stop, leave her alone. Okay, anyway, we'll go on further with her. And then she came to worship him and saying, Lord, help me. And he answered and said, it is not good to take the children's bread and to throw it to the little dogs. That's literally what it says. Most translations just say dogs, but it is puppies is the idea there. The little dogs, the house pet kind of dog, not the dogs that most people would have thought of in those days. And she said, yes, Lord. Yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from the master's table. I want you to notice Jesus' response to that. Then Jesus answered and said, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be done to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. Now, she's not a Jew. This woman's a Gentile. She acknowledges that he is the son of David. She's desperate. And even when it seems that Jesus was not paying attention to her request, she doesn't give up and turn around and go. She stays at it. And it just shows the desperation that she found herself in. Jesus departed there from there and skirted the Sea of Galilee and went up to the mountain and sat down there. And a great multitude came to him, having been with and having with them the lame, the blind, the mute, the maimed, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, and the maimed made whole, and the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Now, where is he? If he was in Jewish territory, what would it say? It would say the Lord or God. If he is somewhere else outside of Jewish territory, and they glorified the God of whom? Israel. That is, now we know this better because Matthew doesn't give us the geographic area as precisely as Mark does. Mark tells us where he is. He's in the Decapolis. He's on the other side of the lake. He's in the area that Satan rules. The Jews didn't go over there. Those were the 10 cities. They were pagan. That's where the pigs are. You know you're not in Jewish territory when you have pigs. Okay. And then now, so you know where he is, right? You know, if you look on a map, if you're looking at a map of Israel, he's on the right side. He's over there. Now Jesus called the disciples to himself and said, I have compassion on the multitude because they have continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I do not want to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. Then his disciples said to him, where could we get enough bread in the wilderness to fill such a great multitude? It's like, how soon do you forget? Jesus answered, well, how many loaves do you have? And they said, well, 7 and a few little fish. We don't know where they got them. This isn't the little boy's lunch as feeding the 5,000. Perhaps this is their own food supply that they have. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves and the fish and gave thanks and broke them and gave it to his disciples. And the disciples gave it to the multitude. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large basketfuls full of the fragments that were left. Now those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. And he set away the multitude and got into a boat and came to the region of Magdala. Okay, so he's going back across, but he's at the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, the northern edge, that's where he's going back to. But see, the point, though, if I can emphasize this point, is that Jesus now is in Gentile territory by design, by choice. He's been referred to by the Syrophoenician woman, the son of David. And then he goes from that region, which is up by the Mediterranean, but then he goes across and comes down the other side of the Sea of Galilee in just rank Gentile territory. And he feeds them. Just like he did the Jewish population on the other side of the lake a few chapters prior. Most believe that Matthew writes to a Jewish audience primarily. And we talked about this several weeks ago, why that is. One indication, of course, is the strict adherence to the genealogy of Jesus, pointing out that he does go back to David. But it's the genealogy of Joseph, not Mary. Mary's is located in Luke's gospel. Well, that's one indication. Another indication is his frequent use of kingdom of heaven as a substitute for the kingdom of God. Because Jews, especially that period of history, were very concerned about a reference to God. So they would often use synonyms that were thought to be kind of less sacred. If you remember, you don't know yet. You may know that, but when we get to the scene of Jesus before Pilate, before Pilate, before the Sanhedrin, the high priest asks Jesus specifically. But the way he says it is very important, and Matthew recorded that way. Are you the son of the Blessed One? He doesn't say, are you the son of God? Are you the son of the Blessed One? I remember a number of years ago learning about what's called the Septuagint, or as my professor once said, correcting us, he said the Septuagint. What it was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, because the scribes realized that Hebrew was losing ground, and they were afraid that one day no one would be able to read Hebrew, therefore no one would know what the Old Testament contains. So they translated it from Hebrew into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. 70 Hebrew scholars did that. As I was learning a little bit about that, at least my professor described this kind of activity, you do know that in the Old Testament, some 300 times, God's name is there. Most English translations, you would not know that, because they use a substitute. The word L-O-R-D, Lord, in caps, indicating that that's God's name. And what they were doing there, they were following a Jewish practice. Because the Jewish scholars primarily, they believed that God's name was so holy, they had to not, you can't just write it down. They would actually, the scribes, would, when they came to God's name, YHWH, that's the consonants was there, they would change ink, and they would change clothes. Because simply, not even to say it, but just to write it, there had to be a deep sense of reverence. And that's why they just didn't speak God's name out. publicly. And I've told you before, we don't really know for the sure the pronunciation, because only the high priest would utter the name, and he could only do it once a year. Other than that, God's name wasn't mentioned, even though it's over 300 times in the Old Testament. So that's another indication about the reference to God, the reverence for it, that he was writing to Jewish people. Now here is the interesting dynamic. When we get to chapter 15, the focus is Gentiles, at least a good portion of the chapter. Now that's surprising, but it shouldn't be, because the Messiah came for not just simply the Jewish people. The Jewish people were offered at first. That's why Jesus says that he came for the lost sheep of Israel. But his acceptance and concern for the Gentiles is vividly displayed here. And we would struggle with, we don't struggle with that because we've become accustomed. But if we were of Jewish descent, we would find this somewhat startling. That you'd find that kind of reference there to Gentiles. Questions or comments?
I mean, I've always read it like you said before, and I'm sure you know. But just in what you've been saying here and looking at this again, the disciples and in feeding the 4,000 when they, you know, I wonder if they were just real forgetful of what happened before, or they were thinking, I don't know if we want to feed these people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wonder if they're, you know, I'd never thought of that before, but then looking at it in light of all the other, I'm sure that wasn't their greatest thing.
When Jesus went over, remember the demoniac that met him, the two from the tombs? And then one of those asked Jesus, I want to follow you. And Jesus said, no. Don't go back to your family, go back to your friends and tell them what the God of Israel has done for you. Even though we may be surprised with this, that region was primed and ready for the gospel to come to them. The 10 cities there on that side, they were primed and ready. And you almost think, maybe, that former demoniac, demon-possessed man, maybe he did a lot of telling people about what the God of Israel had done for him. You'll pick up on this, too, by the way God is referred to. He'll be referred to as the God of Israel, indicating you're in a non-Israeli area. Or they will say something, the demons usually will say, the Most High God. And those are not incident. That lets you know where you are. Okay. Other questions or comments? Yes.
Is the Septuagint an accurate translation since it was read to describe?
Yeah, if it's accurate. Now it is different. It is different because of the translation process in places. And you will find that the New Testament apostles seem to be more familiar with the Septuagint than they are the Hebrew. Because it was more readily available, I guess, and more people were aware of it. Some of the Paul's quotations obviously come from the Septuagint. Because sometimes, you see, we don't have time to enter into this right now, but I'd like just to let you know something about translations. It's very complicated. It's not just simply taking, here's a Greek word, and here's the English equivalent. It's not that easy. And especially it's not that much easy with Hebrew. There might be a Hebrew verse, an Old Testament verse, that looks like it's composed of about, you know, six words. But in English, you may find 12. Because There is, because there's so much there. It's like I mentioned to you before. In English, there's about 100,000 words. In Biblical Hebrew, there's 7,000 words. So when you're going from one language to another, you got a lot more variety. Here's some other things to bear in mind. You have to know, when you're translating, you need to know who is your target audience. Because that will limit the words you have to choose from. If you have an NIV, you have an 8th grade reading level. Okay? It's an 8th grade reading level. So it limits the word choice that's available to you. If you have a New American Standard, it is a 10th grade reading level. Or maybe sometimes some will call it 11th grade reading level. Or what ought to be an 11th grade reading level. So that opens up avenues for a little more complex word usage. If you get down to the New Living Translation, it's about a 4th grade reading level. Now, so a translator has to consider that. And also, it has to consider word usage. What do words mean? How are they used today? For example, this always bugged me. Well, it's in the gospel. Jesus, he wants the children to come. He's going to bless them. Suffer the little children to come unto me. When you're a kid, you kind of wonder about that. Because you know what suffer means, right?
Do your chores.
What's he going to do if you're going to suffer them? Or in the passage dealing with the rapture of the church, so to speak, in 1 Thessalonians 4. He said, those of us who are alive and remain will not prevent those who have fallen asleep. Prevent? Well, no. Today we would say proceed, or we would not go before them. Proceed. Words change meanings over the years, over usages. And so translators need to be very much aware of that. They have to be aware of how literal can they get and still be readable. And that makes a big challenge. So is the Septuagint accurate? Yeah. Is it identical to the Hebrew text? No. Because there was more Greek words available to them than Hebrew words. So there was a little bit of change there in some places. Not a whole lot of places, but some places. One of the most notable has to do with Isaiah, well, for most people, some people, Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. When the RSV, the Revised Standard Version, first came out, there was a lot of fundamentalists that would gather them up and burn them. Because Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 reads that a maiden will conceive and bear a son. You will call his name Emmanuel. It's the word. The word that's used there in the original Hebrew text literally means a woman of marriageable age. So the translators of the RSV chose to break with tradition and just translate it as a young maiden. She's old enough to be married, but that's far they say. Now here comes the translator, but see that word, Alma. Not Alma of the road, but Alma. What it means is, it can mean a virgin, but it doesn't have to mean a virgin. The translators of the Septuagint, they came along, and they chose a Greek word. They could have chose a different Greek word, but they chose a particular Greek word that means only one thing. Only one thing. It cannot mean anything other than one thing. Virgin. So that shows us that these Hebrew scholars of yesteryear, that's how they understood that verse, that word. They understood it to refer to virgin, not simply a young woman. You follow that? Is any translation perfect? The answer is no. Most translations are good translations until they're not. How will you know the difference? Well, just have more than one. And you can kind of compare. You're not going to go wrong with a reputable translation. You're going to understand it. Unless you're reading the Geneva Bible, you probably won't. It's English, but you won't understand. Anyway. I'm going to tell you something. I thought this was funny. Years ago, I was down at the Passion Play. And the Passion Play, they have a little, kind of like a little Bible museum there. Not very many things in it. But they have a facsimile, a copy of the Wicked Bible. And that was cool to see it. And it wasn't the original one, but it was cool to see the copy of it. Most people had never heard of the Wicked Bible, but I had. I don't know how, but some of their class it came up. They were using movable type, which would be a long, laborious process to printing the Bible, wouldn't it? Well, whoever was doing the setting of the type left out a three-letter word. Thou shalt commit adultery. There wasn't a whole lot of those printed before somebody caught it. So that's called the Wicked or the Evil Bible. So it's not anything to do with translation. It's a printing mistake. Okay. But I could go on for a long time about the complexities. So just be thankful to God that there are men out there that devote their lives to a language that is no longer in use and learn everything they can about it in order to translate it in ways that you and I can understand it. All minds clear? I was hoping something would be sticking in your mind, but if your mind is clear, I guess we're done. Have a good evening.